Hello and a very festive welcome back to the Studio Canal Presents podcast. My name is Simon Brew from Film Stories magazine, and this is a regular podcast celebrating one of the biggest and deepest film libraries in the world. Studio Canal's extensive catalogue of films brings together cinema from around the globe, going back over a century. The full library is over 6,000 titles strong. It includes music documentaries, Amazing Grace and The Beatles, 8 days a week. Classic dramas such as The Elephant Man and A Prophet. And what about some quiet action movies like Free Fire and Rambo 3? In this podcast, we're going to do our very best to explore it all. In previous episodes, we've gone for a spin with the driver. We jumped on a choo-choo for the railway children. But now it's our very first festive special with a pair of seasonal treats to explore. In a while, you're going to hear me talking to comedian Suze Kempner about the Christmas film that made my childhood, the extraordinary, I do mean extraordinary, Dudley Moore and John Lithgow cult classic Santa Claus the Movie.
What did you bring? What did I get?
Wait. Don't I hear something first?
But we're kicking off with Carol, director Todd Haynes' 2015 romance about an aspiring photographer finding love with a wealthy older woman in snowy 1950s New York.
I wonder if you might help me find this doll for my daughter.
Bright Betsy. Oh, she cries and wets herself. But I'm afraid we're all out of stock.
Oh, left it too long.
Well, we have plenty of other dolls and all kinds, actually.
Right. What was your favorite doll when you were four?
Joining me to discuss Carol is critic, author and broadcaster Casper Salmon. And Casper, first of all, welcome.
Thank you.
Secondly, I've got here, you used to be a child actor as well. Is this true?
It is true, for my sins. I acted, well, you know, I tried to act between the ages of 10 and 15. Going to auditions and somehow getting parts, but basically by looking a little bit soulful, I think.
Okay.
And one thing I had going for me was that I was incredibly tiny. And so when I was 10, I seemed to be 7. When I was 15, I looked 11. And so you could cast me as younger roles. And, you know, and I wasn't such a pain as younger children might have been on a set. So that sort of worked in my favour. And I did, yeah, I did three movies, a miniseries and a play in the space of 5 years. And then burnt out.
Burnt out that quickly. So your critic career is just buoyed up by the residuals you get from that early acting work.
Oh, my gosh. The money stopped coming in. Long ago. For a while, they showed one of my films on TV, and it was always a Christmas treat for the rest of my schooling years. But then, yeah, that all that all played out.
It wasn't a Saw movie or anything like that, was it?
I'm afraid not, okay. No. A Henry James adaptation is about as close as I got to a Saw,
okay.
Saw film, which
okay.
is not
There's
at
a crossover
all
we can work on there, though. We could revisit that.
The Turn of the Saw.
Yeah, I think so. I think we've sorted that. Excellent. Well, another film that you weren't in, I don't think it's a massive spoiler, is Carol. But I wonder if we can just take a step back, because Carol is, of course, a Todd Haynes film. But when did you first fall in love with a Todd Haynes movie? Was Carol your first?
No, my first Todd Haynes film was Velvet Goldmine. And that was an incredibly important film for me when I was at university. Todd Haynes and directors like Todd Solondz and Paul Thomas Anderson were making films at that time that I found incredibly exciting and that spoke to me and people of my age. And so I was really getting into cinema around then. And Velvet Goldmine was huge for me, not least because it's such a gay film. And I was kind of, you know, discovering stuff around then.
Yeah.
Todd Haynes, when he came on the scene, was part of the new queer cinema.
Yeah.
And all of that new scene of American directors, including Tom Kalin and Greg Araki.
Yeah.
These new filmmakers were doing something that was really confrontational and in your face. And they were talking about AIDS and they were talking about sex in new pared down ways and in indie ways. You know, these were small films, but that still had a lot of power. And Todd Haynes was very much from that kind of DIY school. But what happened was from Safe onwards, he started to acquire more polish, I think. And with Velvet Goldmine, that was supposed to be his sort of big arrival into the mainstream with a much bigger and much more well-known cast. You know, you're looking at Ewan McGregor and Tony Collette, who are both kind of at the peak of their powers, Christian Bale. And people really didn't know what to make of it. But I think it has been reappraised in recent years.
My first was... the first one I properly got into was Far From Heaven.
Right.
In part, I got it because it had President Palmer from 24 in it.
Oh, yeah.
The best president in 24, I think that's fairly clear. can you chart a little bit Todd Haynes' career from Velvet Goldmine through to Carol?
I think by the time he moved from Velvet Goldmine to Far From Heaven, he was kind of playing on queer cinema and on a queer aesthetic, but really kind of reveling in the image much more than he had done before and toying with a kind of classicism that you hadn't seen in his work before. Far From Heaven is an original story, but it's heavily indebted to Douglas Sirk.
Yeah.
After his next film, I'm Not There, I think it's called, which he did write, but which is based very much on the life of Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
After that, he basically stopped writing his own material.
Yeah.
And Carol was the first film that he hadn't written.
He wasn't the first person attached to Carol either, or certainly linked with it. This was a project that had a lot of hills to get over just before it even ended up on his desk. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. The script by Phyllis Nash had been kind of doing the rounds in Hollywood for a while, and Cate Blanchett had been attached for a gazillion years. And it came to Todd Haynes. And you can really see that in the film. You can see that it's not his property, but what's really interesting about it is the way it's an exercise for him. It's the challenge, and you can see him you can see him really
almost
plying,
a custodian of it.
Yeah, exactly. He's plying his trade, if you will. You can see him taking pleasure in adapting himself to this project that is so beautifully written and which fits in with his career in so many ways, you know, the queer story and his love of period. There's lots going on that ties it to his own career, but you can see that he's acting here as, your word of a custodian is about right. He's acting in a kind of different capacity.
I mean, it's quite a snobby phrase sometimes, isn't it, to say that someone's come to a project as a director for hire, but that seems to be a little bit of what you're saying here.
And
a director for hire that in this case was like the perfect person for it.
Yeah, he's a really good match for it. In Carol, he is the perfect match. But the word perfect is interesting here because Carol is perfect. It's a perfect film. I'd like to see something a little bit more jagged in there, maybe. But I definitely think that's the most interesting thing about it, is the way he's kind of created something that is so lush, so incredibly inviting, and which in every aspect of its composition is utterly, you know, fluid and gorgeous.
I remember around the time Carol coming out, the story was he'd had a long time to edit this. Is that part and parcel of what you're getting at there? Just like that, making sure that every rough edge of it is smoothed down?
Yeah, it's there in the edit, absolutely. Like, the rhythm of Carol is just, it's exquisite.
Yeah.
The way it starts off with that scene between Carol and Therese where we see them in a restaurant and they're talking and they are interrupted by somebody mid-conversation. That's reference to Brief Encounter, in which the two lovers are interrupted in the station by somebody who doesn't know that they're parting, and she's interrupting the most heartbreaking moment of both of their lives.
Therese! Is that you? What do you know? I'm saying to myself, I know that girl.
Jack.
Gee, it's great to see you, Therese. It's been months.
Months. Jack, this is Carol Ayer.
Pleased to meet you.
Likewise.
It's referenced really beautifully in this Todd Haynes film, and the edit gives us that scene again later on, as we see also in Brief Encounter.
Yeah.
You replay the scene from the perspective of the lovers who've been interrupted, and you understand exactly what has happened between them.
I'm meeting some people at the Oak Room at 9. If you want to have dinner, if you change your mind, I think you'd like them.
But Haynes is, what he does is he reverses the brief encounter styling so that this moment, which appears to be an ending between them, is in fact a moment when the roles are actually just reversed between the two, between Carol and Therese. And this is the moment where Therese, played by Rooney Mara, decides actually that to take matters into her own hands, and she'll be the one who's courting from now on. She's going to be the one who's actually going to go after Carol.
I love you.
So Cate Blanchett was attached to this for a long time. Mm-hmm. But Rooney Mara, the story that I've got on this is she was approached about it, originally turned it down. Mia Wasikowska was cast in that role and then dropped out fairly late in the day. And then Rooney Mara comes back in. And I mean, it's an Academy Award, a deservedly Academy Award nominated performance from Rooney Mara. So we've talked a little bit about Todd Haynes slotting in at the right point for the film in his life. Mm-hmm. But what about these performers? So Cate Blanchett was there all along. Rooney Mara to come that late seems quite a stroke of luck almost.
She's perfect casting,
isn't she?
I think.
Isn't she?
To act opposite Cate Blanchett. Mia Wasikowska, I think, would have been all wrong. Just in terms of her energy and I think her screen persona. What's really interesting with Rooney Mara is the age gap that would have been there with Mia Wasikowska as well. But the age gap is played on really, really beautifully, particularly in the first scene where they meet each other, where Rooney Mara's character, Therese, is working in a department store. And the dynamic between the two is quite subversive, I think, because Carol approaches Therese as the inspiration for a present for her child.
Yeah.
And she's trying to buy a toy for her daughter, who's like four, I think.
Yeah.
And she says to her, what would you have wanted when you were four? What did you like? So she's like, she's sort of considering this woman who she's attracted to and who she will have a love affair with in filial terms. And I think that's pretty on the nose and subversive. And Todd Haynes kind of smuggles that into this perfect picture.
Forgive me, shopping makes me nervous.
That's all right, working here makes me nervous.
You're very kind. Here she is.
Oh, she looks like you, around the eyes.
You think so? What did you want when you were this age?
And Rooney Mara, she's also somebody whose scream persona is kind of dependent on trauma. And we think of Rooney Mara as somebody kind of very vulnerable, I think.
Of her eating a pie in a ghost story.
Right, eating a pie. She's sort of somebody who kind of undergoes torture, I think, a lot. And here she has a bit more to her, a bit more inner strength. But she's perfect for playing that kind of much more passive character to Carol's inhabited, much more forceful character.
The film also is an adaptation of Patricia Highsmith's novel, The Price of Salt, which dates back to 1952. And Highsmith also wrote The Likes of Strangers on a Train, the Ripley books, Deep Water. Did you watch that? The non-erotic erotic thriller?
I'm afraid to say I did.
Did you like it?
Not at all.
Okay. But is there an undercurrent of sex and eroticism to her writing, and particularly to this work?
Yeah. Carol is really interesting from a sexual point of view, I think.
It's better than Deep Water as well.
It's much better than Deep Water, which is sort of weirdly unerotic, but in quite an interesting way, I think. Like, I think Deep Water was kind of missold. Basically, everybody was told that this was a return to kind of cheap and nasty, sexy 90s thrillers. And
yes, we'd have loved that. Yeah,
Wouldn't that have been fabulous?
Yeah.
And in Carol, the women are considered very much from a public perspective. And we always see them together in public. We're looking at them from a societal point of view.
Yeah.
And we see how being in public and having to put on a performance together is kind of pushing them together in a way, but also eating them up. And you can see like that tension between them. And so when it gets to the sex scene between them, which I do think is too restrained in the film, I'd have liked something...
You want more chandeliers by that point.
Yeah, I'd have liked just a little bit more juice. But it's a beautiful, restrained sex scene. It's very lush, I think, and gorgeous and erotic.
Yeah.
And you really feel the love between them, especially. I think it's a sex scene that produces all of that kind of growing intimacy and love and connection between these women.
So that's the deal. I cannot negotiate anymore. You take it or leave it.
It's interesting to see Kate Blanchett in restrained mode, I think.
Yeah.
Because she's an actor who tends to kind of go over if she's given permission. In a good way, and I love that about Kate Blanchett, is that she's a highly stylized actor. And you expect her to unleash some Blanchett fury at times, particularly in the scene with her husband where there's a big confrontation. And she threatens him and she says, you know, we'll take this to court if it has to be, and then it'll get ugly. And that's about as big as it gets.
Yeah.
But then her face breaks and she says, but we're not ugly people.
It'll get ugly.
And we're not ugly people, Hodge.
You see this woman's fear and you see her heartbreak and her devastation. And I think that's a moment that's incredibly powerful because you can see the forces of society upon her and all of the things that she has to do, all of her duties, her position in society as a mother, as a beautiful woman, a society woman,
yeah,
a wife. Those have all taken their toll and she has nothing left. And what's interesting in Blanchett's performance is her character seems so put together and so sorted. And she breaks down all of that over the course of the film. And when we see her towards the end in that brief encounter style scene with Therese, we realise that she's the more broken of the two and she's the one who kind of needs rescuing. We thought that she was the one holding all of the cards and you know, leading the dance, to mix my metaphors. But actually, she's a vulnerable woman as well.
Yeah.
And seeing Blanchett perform that is really one of the great joys of the film, I think.
Is it career high, Kate Blanchett, would you say?
Yeah, it's in the Blanchett pantheon.
Good pantheon.
Because I recently saw Tar, and Tar is the film that I was thinking of when I talk about like the Blanchett power and how she wants to go over sometimes. Tar affords her all of those possibilities, and it's a real kind of showboating turn. And I think Carol is a more expressive performance, is a more controlled one maybe, and it's perhaps more interesting for the way it kind of subsumes all of those qualities that she has.
I love Christmas, wrapping presents and all that. And then somehow you wind up overcooking the turkey anyway.
Is Carol a Christmas movie?
Yes, it is. Carol's in the Christmas canon now.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting one to think about in terms of Christmas movies, because my belief is that, by and large, the Christmas movie genre is antithetical to queerness, because the Christmas movie is all about celebrating family and birth, and it's about celebrating the way society kind of affirms those institutions. And I think queer people are often rejected from those celebrations. Yeah. And a lot of queer people I know don't enjoy Christmas. I mean, you know, loads of them do love it as well. It's full of golden glitter. We're going to get involved in some way. But some gay people I know feel, around the time of Christmas, like they're not really kind of involved, you know. They might be a bit of an albatross or feel at a remove from family. Some queer people don't get on with their families. So Christmas is a kind of difficult time. And as an institution, it's all about affirming family and about affirming kind of conformity.
Yeah.
And, you know, materialism, all of this capitalist stuff that really puts us at a distance. And yet Carol kind of manages to mesh those two warring modes, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Because these women are on the edge of family, and Blanchett's family is falling apart. She's in the middle of a divorce. And yet what it does is it pushes these two characters together and they create a kind of makeshift Christmas of their own.
Yeah.
And that is incredibly beautiful when you see them in Carol's house and the decorations are up and they've sort of, in their own different way, they've queered Christmas. And it's beautiful. They have made it up and they've turned it on its head. And so that's what's so beautiful, one of the beautiful things about Carol, and what makes it a Christmas film, and what makes it a queer Christmas film furthermore. Soon it will be
Christmas Day. So Carol is available to stream on the Studio Canal Presents channel on Apple TV and Prime Video right now. It's also available on DVD and Blu-ray. And Casper, will it be on your television set this Christmas? I mean, that's the killer question, surely.
It might very well be, you know. I think the whole family has seen it, but it's good for another go around.
And one more question. Are you a fan of Santa Claus the Movie, starring Dudley Moore.
I haven't even seen it.
And that's the Christmas treat we're going to turn our attention to now. A huge production shot in the UK back in the 1980s. Let's take you into what at one stage becomes Santa Claus's origin story with a clip from Santa Claus the Movie. I'll be talking to comedian Suze Kempner about the film right after this.
Welcome. It's the Vendicum.
Little people.
We prefer to be called elves, if you don't mind. You.
I'm the one called Dooley. We've been expecting you.
Expecting us?
For a long, long time. We almost gave up hope.
So, Suze, we like to start with our guests by getting a piece of trivia about them or just some fact that we don't know. And I know your fact, and I'm pretty confident you are about to raise the bar of this segment of the show to a level that can never in all time be beaten. Suze, what is your fact?
My fact is that through family connections, my cat played Jonesy in Aliens.
So not in Alien, in Aliens.
Yeah, the second movie, that is my childhood pet, Boris.
I can't leave that just as you stating that fact and me not following it up. How on earth did your cat get to be Jonesy in Aliens?
It's literally, my mum worked for this woman who got animals for film and TV and stage. And she said, yeah, we've got quite a specific brief. We need a ginger cat, ginger all over, that can hiss on camera. And my mum went, oh, our cat's Ginger, and all you'd have to do is get another cat out of a box and show it to him and he'd hiss. And so that's how Boris ended up being in Aliens.
And was Boris a nice cat?
No.
Perfect casting.
He used to bully other cats, and he was all right to people, but everything on very much on his terms.
So his punishment was to appear against, like, extraterrestrials with acid for blood.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, but I think he'd have had him. I mean, he survives the movie.
So then, Suze,
yeah.
Let's talk about Santa Claus : the Movie. Now, I'm an old man. I watched this film in the 1980s when it came out. You are not an old man. When did this first come into your life?
Literally, last night was the first time I watched it. I knew it existed. It's from the year I was born. It came out in 85. So Santa Claus the Movie and I were both birthed in 85.
I have no idea what someone looking at this film through purely modern eyeballs would make of it.
It's a strange movie because it's about an hour and 40, and there's sort of an hour of very languid stuff at the North Pole. And I mean, we open with Santa and his wife's brutal death from exposure.
You can't see your hand in front of your face out there. You won't get through.
My reindeer, Donner and Blitzen can get through anything. Come along, Anya. We must hurry. More children need their toys on the other side of the forest.
It's a bit dark, isn't it?
It really, I was going, bloody hell, if I saw this as a kid, I'd have been incredibly traumatised. It was like that film Legend, you know, the film where Tim Curry plays darkness and he's basically Satan. That's got loads of stuff with people nearly dying of exposure, which I found very traumatic as a child. This, it just, Santa Claus is dead, kids. But then there's lots of very gorgeous Christmas card stuff with them at the North Pole, and I guess it's the afterlife, and now Santa is Santa. And I thought the rendering of the workshops, all the sets with the elves and stuff, was just stunning. It was so beautiful.
What is all this?
They're Christmas toys. Waiting for you.
But it's so languid. And then all of a sudden, like 40 minutes before the end, it's like, right, here's a whole movie's worth of plot. Bang, bang, bang.
Because the opening's a bit the good, the bad and the ugly, isn't it? Where Clint Eastwood is just dragged out to bake and die. What I love about this film is it owes in part its existence to the finest Superman film, which is obviously Superman 3.
Right.
And to Supergirl as well.
Oh.
I don't know if you know this, but the producers, the Salkins, after the disappointment of their third Superman and Supergirl films at the box office, they decided to put their many millions into this.
I see.
And as you said, I mean, they put their millions on screen.
I mean, this film must have cost a fortune. You've got Dudley Moore sort of at the height of his powers.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a stellar cast. It looks expensive, special effects aside. But also, you've got Henry Mancini doing the music. There's songs by the people who brought you Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And
yeah, it's Leslie Bricusse.
You Only Live Twice. Like, this is a pricey movie.
Christmas is the best of days. Who's the happy cause? It's our favourite person. Mine and yours, Santa Claus.
So I'm going to hit you with trivia you might not know about it. Mm-hmm. Because there's a version of Santa Claus the movie that almost never happened.
Okay.
Because one of the original people they were talking to about doing it was John Carpenter.
Oh, so we could have got even darker.
Well, yes, and with a different font at the start. We've talked about John Carpenter's lovely fonts on this podcast before. But reading through the history of this, because this was like, they weren't making films of this size in the UK very often in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. And it was attracting lots and lots of people. And the Salkinds weren't shy about approaching people. So I was reading that some of the other directors, Robert Wise from the original The Day the Earth Stood Still, he was in the running for it.
Really?
Lewis Gilbert with three Bond films, including Moonraker.
Right.
Moonraker, amazing. And then casting-wise, the people they didn't get, because you mentioned Dudley Moore, and it was Dudley Moore, what, just post 10 and Arthur, wasn't it?
Yeah, Arthur's what? So that's 1981?
Yeah.
And he's given it everything.
He really is as well.
Yeah.
There's no cynicism to the performances in this either. They turn up and they earn their checks.
He says goodbye to the reindeer like it's a gritty Oscar-winning performance. Like, I bought it.
Oh, boys. I'm going to miss you. You know that, don't you?
Did you cry?
I didn't cry because I'm dead inside, but I bought it.
Imagine the versions then, because these were some of the names. I don't know how close some of these people came to it. The Burgess Meredith role had names such as James Cagney and Fred Astaire linked to it.
Oh, wow. Right.
Mr. Corporate Bastard, let's call him that, ultimately played by John Lithgow. We've got to come to him in a minute. Harrison Ford was offered that and turned it down.
That would have been a subtler performance. And all the worse for it.
What are you trying to say?
I love it. I thought, because I got sort of 50 minutes in and went, I swear John Lithgow's in this movie.
Yes.
And then there he appears, like, chewing the scenery in the most wonderful way. Because I do feel like this movie is two different movies competing with each other. I would have watched 3 hours of John Lithgow's movie.
Listen, you make toys, right?
Are you from the Federal Trade Commission?
No, I'm from the North Pole.
Listen, Junior, I've got enough on my mind without having to deal with an escaped lunatic.
So John Lithgow comes into the final third of the movie basically as the prototype Jeff Bezos.
Yeah.
Tell us about your response to the mighty Lithgow in this.
Oh, I raised my arms to the ceiling. I was so grateful. He's an absolute hoot. I mean, that first scene with him and Dudley Moore, I just thought, oh, that must have been a right laughter film. Weirdly, that's where the film is at its most 80s, but that's also the most timeless thing because we haven't learned a thing, obviously. So that whole storyline with those two, I went, oh, yeah, no, this is the stuff that holds up really well.
What experience do you have in toy manufacture?
Come on, I'm entirely elf-taught.
One takeaway I had, because Santa in this is played by David Huddleston.
Zaddy. And he had Zaddy vibes.
What, a Zaddy? What's a Zaddy?
Yeah, it's like a hot daddy.
Okay, excellent. I keep learning new terms. This is the podcast where I learned what BDE is.
Ah, okay. I think the Zaddy Santa has BDE.
Okay.
Yeah.
Excellent.
They love their Uncle Claus, huh?
Well, the thing is, he is the grubbiest Santa. I mean, I don't wish to be disrespectful. You know, the work of Santa is very difficult when you consider what he's got to have to do. But he could have a wash. He also is very, very determined to maintain the patriarchy.
Absolutely.
His elf workshop. I mean, you check your chromosomes in at the door there, don't you?
It's not a female-heavy movie, is it? Also, if you like elf puns, they don't hold back.
Go on, give us some elf puns.
Oh, well, several of them are repeated. Yeah. Dudley Moore, doing it with, like, no self-consciousness whatsoever, it's like, yeah, I'm elf-taught.
It's not a bad gag, is it?
It's but you'll hear it a lot.
Oh, then be elf-conscious.
So, Suze, you told me that you wrote notes while you were watching this ahead of this conversation. Do you have those notes with you? I mean, are there any bullet points, really, that you could share?
My first note says, I love the wooden bad child acting in the opening scene. The there's some like bad child acting in the opening scene, which was very 80s. Like, kids are better actors now, and there's just a kid going, has he arrived yet? I've written, did we need to have a scene where a boy tortures a cat?
Yes, we did.
Oh, it is to show a kid being naughty or nice. I think torturing animals could have been replaced by the boy being a jerk to his sister or something. And then three notes later, I wrote, it made me hug my cat a little tighter.
Aww.
Tell you what, the bit that made me go, what, the most, was when suddenly we cut to, like, a kid in New York. And she puts out a bowl of food and a can of Coke for, like, a feral child. I said out loud, what are they doing now? Because, yeah, the film kept making me go, oh, okay, it's this, is it? Oh, no, it isn't. Oh, it's this. If I was a kid, I would have absolutely gone mad for this. It would have been watched over and over again.
I was a kid, and not only did we get to go and see Santa Claus the movie with all the hype leading up to it on the big screen, we got to have a Wimpy afterwards.
Oh, sweet. That's very 80s.
I'm launching a campaign, I've decided, to get this an IMAX re-release next year. Would your response to it be enough to put you off joining my campaign?
I think this in IMAX would rival films like Guardians of the Galaxy in IMAX. I think this is a way to get like a second... Because this was a huge hit, this film, in the
yeah,
UK.
Yeah.
And imagine, you could double that money just by putting it in IMAX.
Well, James Cameron would just give up making Avatar sequels, wouldn't he?
Yeah, he'd be like, they've done what? Oh, what's the point of this anymore? And he'd throw his Titanic Oscar in the sea, like the Star of the Ocean.
To anyone who's kind of toying with the idea of giving Santa Claus the movie a try, I'm utterly biased on this.
Yeah.
Through your colder, more modern eyes than mine, what would you say to those people who pick up the Blu-ray and just think, shall I give this a go?
Oh, definitely do, because there's nothing like it. I was watching it going like, they really took a massive swing with this. It's like bolder than... Because I saw it as... I was watching it going, oh, this is kind of the children's version of Scrooged, the Bill Murray movie.
That's interesting.
But it's bolder than that. Because they've done it for kids. They've done it for families. And it really is family entertainment because there's stuff for kids, there's stuff for adults. And that's so rare.
And it does look gorgeous.
Yeah. Oh, the money spent on this.
When you've got a hit like we have, Patch, the people don't want to wait a whole year. They're dying for a sequel. A sequel. That's it. We'll bring it out on March 25th. And we'll call it... Christmas too.
At the end of the film, right?
Yeah.
Santa is still Santa. He's still delivering presents. He's still got a very male-heavy workforce, although a couple of extra personnel are added to it. So if we're going to do a sequel, Suze, to go with that IMAX re-release of the film, where would we take it now? Do we do, like, John Lithgow origins?
I don't know. I think he's gone now. Like, we've had our lift go.
That's harsh.
But I think the second movie should be Mrs. Santa Claus Gets Her Groove Back, and it takes place in on a tropical island.
I see that. And the second one could actually have Rudolph in it as well.
Yeah.
There's lots of reindeer.
It's very trad, all the North Pole stuff. Yeah, there's no Rudolph. Yeah, Rudolph and Santa Claus's wife, just they embrace island living. Yeah, what a dream.
Okay, we've made a cinematic universe here. Amazing.
The Santa Claus, the movie cinematic universe, yeah.
Suze Kempner, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can buy Santa Claus, the movie on DVD and Blu-ray right now. My one-man campaign for an IMAX release of the movie in 2023 is now underway. Now, though, let's turn to some other matters arising in the world of Studio Canal, because there's lots and lots going on. Studio Canal has been busy in television of late, and it's partnered with comics legend Frank Miller for a six-part series based on Italian comic book creator Hugo Pratt's Corto Maltese. Now, Miller, the brains behind Sin City, for instance, is set to develop the project with the studio, and one key hire has already been practical effects genius Phil Tippett. He's signed up for the production. Expect more news on that in 2023. back on the big screen, a biopic of dancer, singer and actor Josephine Baker has taken a step forward. Cuties director Mamana Doucouré is writing and directing the movie, and Baker's sons have endorsed the telling of their late mother's story. The plan is to shoot this one in 2023, and casting details of it aren't far away. And that's it for this episode of Studio Canal Presents. Next time, we're going for some winter chills with the frosty ghost story, The Queen of Spades. Now, that should be perfect for the long winter nights. In the meantime, to find out more about Studio Canal Films and the Apple TV and Prime Video channel, you can visit www.studiocanal.co.uk or follow Studio Canal at Studio Canal UK on Twitter, Instagram and TikTok. For now, though, I'm off to the North Pole to help Santa clean up the mess that Dudley Moore made back in 1985. On behalf of everyone here, have a lovely Christmas and New Year. I'll see you back in 2023 for the next episode of Studio Canal Presents. Ta-ta for now.